Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Wildcard Wednesday will start a little bit later as you, the listener, program all the music that we hear bumps coming from the breaks. Tonight's Wildcard Wednesday. Yeah. 312-981-7200. Rod Pyle, one of my favorite guests, is an award-winning author. He's a journalist, and he speaks a lot about space. Some big stuff happened in the world of space last week, and we've got some space stories, especially concerning Juno and Jupiter. And we'll talk about that and much more. And let's get, without further ado, let's have Rod Pyle come in. Hiya, Rod.
Good evening, Professor. How are you?
Oh. I'm all right, sir. How are you doing?
Well, I was doing pretty well until I saw Independence Day resurgence.
Well, would you like to just start, get that out of the way so that we can talk about the good stuff, the fun stuff? Because there's all kinds of stuff involving Jupiter that you're going to have so much fun talking about. Okay, so I have to come clean, Rod. Now, you know I review movies here on this radio station.
Yes, sir.
And I have two partners on Monday mornings with me, and we do a summation of all the box office and the weekend's movies and review them all. And yep. I had seen over the course of the weekend that they both indeed went to see the Independence Day Resurgence sequel. So I chose not to, considering I hated the first movie. Very
hated that one.
I know. So then they reviewed it, and they were not kind to it. And actually, Rod, neither has the American public, because this thing is really tanking.
It's made a little bit more in today's dollars than the first one made, I think, in, what was it, 1996 dollars?
Yeah, yeah. If during its whole run, now I will say, let me ask you this, Rod. You went to see? Did you go to like a special screening of it, or did you see it like at a regular theater?
I just went as a civilian.
All right, and how big was the crowd, or how small was the crowd, or what was it like?
Well, I have to admit, I went to a matinee, so
yeah,
the crowd was smallish, but it was three.
That's smallish. I would describe three definitely as smallish.
Well, if it was a private screening, that would have been okay, you know.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. And,
right.
Yeah, and I should have. I mean, I don't want to be too unkind because it wasn't dreadful, you mm-hmm. know, with enough popcorn and other sorts of slightly more contraband substances, it probably would have been fine. It was just. You know, it was more of the same. It was slow. I think, can I do a little spoiler, or is that a bad
thing? Yeah, go ahead, Rod. Yeah.
I remember, was it Signs where the aliens came down to Earth because they wanted to be here, but they were allergic to water, so you could kill them with a squirt gun?
Exactly right. That was Signs. They were supposed to be these incredibly intelligent aliens who picked a planet that was nothing but water.
Water, right.
Right.
So these guys are coming to Earth, as near as anybody could tell from watching this unbelievably convoluted, granulated plot, because they want magma. And it's like, look, there's a lot of planets with hot cores. A lot of those cores have iron. Unless you're going to use it to hose down human beings, which are really easy to kill with, you know, bullets and stuff like that, or fire.
Yeah.
You don't need lava. So why are you going to hover your 4,000-mile-wide megaship, which is bigger this time,
ooh,
over the ocean and drill while Alien Queen goes around trying to stomp flat kids in a school bus crossing the California desert because she's after the sphere of universal knowledge from the good guys, you know? Mm. It's just kind of, it was stinky.
Yeah, well.
And Jeff Goldblum kept saying, the landmarks, I always go for the landmarks, you know? And I thought, wow, that's what you can do, huh?
Yeah. The first movie, I just, like, truly hated the first film. And I know. And the idea of them making a sequel 20 years later just seemed completely idiotic to me.
Well, then he was going to do, I think he was going to shoot two back-to-back until somebody at the studio wisely said, let's see how the middle one does first, huh?
Well, and from what I understand, what Colin and Eric, my partners, told me the weekend that they reviewed it, that this thing ends with the absolute possibility that there will be, in fact, be a third one.
Yeah, because I don't know if I should say it, but because it's kind of like where they start the second one, which is, okay, we have the technology to fight the aliens if they ever come back, which doesn't go so well for a while, and you have to be really clever and, you know, trip the Alien Queen, and when she falls on her face, all the bad ships fall out of the sky kind of thing.
Yeah.
So now for the setup for the third one, it's like, oh, wait, now we have even better technology. We can go kick their ass out there. I think
right.
That was the idea.
Yeah, that seemed to be what they were saying. Was it like, yeah, we can go get them now? Like Brent Spiner comes out at the end, Data comes out, and is like, yeah. So,
yeah, yeah. If only you had the budget
Yeah. Well, now before we're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes for the news, and then we'll jump into it. Tell everybody about yourself, Rod. You are an award-winning author, journalist. You love space. Tell everybody about how you got started in it and some of the books. You got a new book out, too. Tell everybody about yourself, Rod.
Child of the space age, grew up in the late 50s, very late 50s, I'll have you know, and 60s. And, you know, back then when you turned on the television, 1968, 1969, chances are pretty good every 2 months you were going to see a piece of a moonwalk. And that was pretty addictive. So that became my thing. I wasn't a very good scientist, so I decided I'd better go into media. And I've been doing that ever since. So this year I have Mars Making Contact, which is a new book about the history of the exploration of Mars with lots of pictures. It's great to see picture books coming back. I have Blueprint for Battlestar, which is all about the science of sci-fi. And I have, are you sitting down, Amazing Stories of the Space Age coming out.
I'm very excited about that.
Filled with amazing stories from the space age.
Yeah.
So well, that was a lot of fun. They're all fun.
The book that you put together about the science and sci-fi. Now, explain to everybody. I mean, you were just talking about a movie you reviewed, Independence Day. But you have worked on television shows and you have worked on movies in that realm, in the space realm, correct?
Yeah. I worked on a couple of really bad films. Then I had the good fortune to work on Deep Space Nine for a few seasons, and I worked on a TV movie that Joe Dante made that I think ended up being called Warlord's Battle for the Galaxy or something. That went on for a really long time. I was the last visual effects guy on that. That was tough. Yeah.
Well, you got to work with Joe. You got to work with Joe Dante, though.
Oh no, I never met him.
I never met him.
They had chewed through three effects supervisors, and I was the last guy to come in. They dumped this stuff in my lap, and I kind of went, oh, my God, the spaceship looks like a dolphin. Who designed this thing? So, I mean, it had some good acting, and, you know, Rod Taylor was in it, and the story was kind of cool. It just didn't really hang together.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all have those somewhere.
You know what was really funny? A couple of weeks ago, I busted out my Blade Runner 4-disc set, which, for me, is my favorite science fiction movie ever made.
No, wait, 4-disc being laser discs?
No, CDs. DVDs. There are the four separate cuts of the movie are all in the package.
Oh.
Because there are four different cuts. So the four different cuts are in there. And there's behind-the-scenes stuff and extra footage. And Dangerous Days, which is about the making of Blade Runner. Have you ever seen this documentary?
No, I haven't.
It's 3.5 hours long, Rod. 3.5 hours long. And it is spectacular. This is how thorough it is. 45 minutes of this documentary, 45 full minutes, is dedicated simply to production design.
That's intense.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
I believe there's a behind-the-scenes documentary on the director's cut of Independence Day. I'm going to send you it.
Yeah, that's 5 hours long. They tried to top Blade Runner with that. And, I mean, they have everybody involved in it. You know, I mean, this documentary was made, I believe, at the end of 2007 when the ultimate Ridley Scott cut was finally released. And so it's 3 hours and 35 minutes long, and I watched it again. I hadn't watched it in probably 8 or 9 years, and I watched it 2 weeks ago, and it was as mesmerizing and as amazing. One of the best film documentaries I've ever seen.
Well, and that movie, I mean, amongst everything else, Rutger Hauer's finest hour ever.
Without question.
That last scene.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. And he improvised some of that. Yeah, absolutely. And then they get all the special effects guys, like Doug Trumbull, who is one of the greatest special effects guys ever. And the stunning thing about that movie, Rod, is, you know, there was no computer animation in that movie at all.
Right.
None.
Right.
And you look at the special effects on Blade Runner, they're jaw-dropping. They're absolutely jaw-dropping. So.
And to be fair, you know, there was a lot of digital compositing, but there were very few CGI effects in Interstellar, too, which I know you like.
Yeah,
that was amazing.
Great stuff. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
Okay.
Hold on a second. We got to take a break. Rod Pyle is here. We got some great news to talk about in terms of Juno and Jupiter and much, much more. You've heard his fantastic review of the latest Independence Day film, and we'll talk more with Rod. We got a break here. The news is coming up next, and then more. Morning, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. as we are every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 2 to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 o'clock. And at 6 o'clock, the great Steve Cochran with your morning drive. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 if you want to jump in here. We're talking about space. Any questions, comments? And you can also text anything you want at 312-981-7200, including your Wild Card Wednesday. Yes, your request for Wild Card Wednesday. Any artist, any song, anything for Wild Card Wednesday for bumps, and we'll be playing those back in a little bit. So, all right, Rod Pyle is my guest, an award-winning author, journalist. He is a speaker about space and lots of stuff to talk about. Let's welcome Rod back to the show. Welcome back, Rod.
Hey, thanks.
All right, so let's talk about Juno. There was a lot of footage last week of guys in control rooms jumping up and down and clapping.
Yeah, they're pretty happy. I mean, this is not one of their most expensive missions. It was about $1 billion, I think, but it's certainly one of the most sensational. When you're sending something out close to 2 billion miles by the time it's done traveling in the big loop it's got to do, and you're threading a needle at, you know, a dozen or fewer miles at the other end to try and get the thing into the proper orbit, that's a pretty astonishing moment. So it had to fire its rocket engine for, I think it was 38 minutes on July 4th, which it did, right to the penny. And that managed to break it down slow enough because it was traveling faster than anything that we had built had gone before. I think it was 160,000 miles per hour.
Wow.
Which was a fair percentage faster than the previous record was held by a solar probe back in the 80s, I think it was. So, they had a lot of slowing down to do. And even then, that puts it this big, huge elliptical orbit. They're going to circularize that a little more in October and get into their science orbit. But that's still kind of egg-shaped because they're trying to minimize how much time it spends right at Jupiter, because the Galileo probe, if you remember that, which was there operating in the 90s and early 2000s, flew within 134,000 miles or so of Jupiter, which, you know, when a planet's as big as Jupiter, that's still pretty close. That's eye-filling. And was pretty well toasted by the time they were done with it by radiation. This one's going to fly within 2,000 to 3,000 miles of its closest approach.
Wow.
So it's really, really going to be hard not to get cooked. So they've done everything they can to armor it, but that's one reason the mission's going to last about a year and a half.
Close to 2 billion miles. That's amazing. Yeah.
It really is.
And so what exactly will the Jupiter, what exactly will Juno do? What's the results of it? And what's it going to do? It's going to measure water, correct?
Yeah, it's going to measure water. They're going to measure microwaves from the atmosphere down to about 370, 380 miles, which when you're the size of Jupiter is not that far, but when you figure that most of Earth's atmosphere is only about 10 miles deep, you realize that's a big factor. So they're able to, by looking at different frequencies of microwaves, they can tell how much water is in each of these vertical layers. And water and other elements like that tell them about a lot about, they hope, where the planet was formed, a little bit more about the history of the solar system. Because what we're seeing in these exoplanets and these other solar systems, we're seeing a lot of Jupiter-like planets really close to the sun. So ours is kind of this outlier. You know, it's way out in the outer solar system. And you're thinking, well, why is that? So this will tell us a little more by looking at the ratios of the chemistry in the atmosphere. They'll be able to tell better about whether it formed further out, further in, where it is. And then also the other big thing they're doing, which I think is really fascinating, is they're going to finally try and figure out what's at the core of Jupiter. I went to college in the 70s. I took astronomy at UCLA in the 70s. And they were talking about then, you know, what's the core of Jupiter? It's probably hydrogen. It may be this weirdo form of hydrogen they call metallic hydrogen, which isn't really a fluid, isn't really a solid. It's not really a gas. It conducts electricity. It's just so compressed it acts like a metal. So by orbiting around it, a polar orbit, so that we can see it during the entire course of the orbit face onto Earth, and measuring its speed and its deviations from a perfect course, they're going to be able to tell a lot about the gravitation of the core and what it's formed of. And that's, I mean, we're talking about, I was asking one of the mission scientists, I said, what kind of accuracy are you talking here? And very nonchalantly said, we can track it to about 10 microns per second.
Whoa.
It's 558 million miles away right now. It takes the signal 50 minutes to get here, 50 minutes, and you're tracking it to like millionth of an inch? Well, yeah.
Wow.
Like we do that kind of stuff every day, right?
Oh, man. Wow. That's
I can barely use a ruler anymore.
Wow. What did have people speculated that the core was over the years?
For a long time they thought maybe there wasn't one, then they thought maybe it was rocky, like the terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. Then finally, it just made the most sense that it was this highly compressed form of hydrogen. So they think that that's probably what it is, but there's a lot of speculation that at the core there might be some rocky material. So that's really going to be the big answer in terms of physical structure.
Now, there's a quote in the in a piece that you wrote from a man named William Faulkner.
Yeah.
Nice
guy.
Yeah. And he says...
Loves softballs, apparently.
That's what I'm talking... Tell everybody about that.
Well, we had to go through that a couple of times because I wasn't quite sure I was getting it at first. But I think it's basic because it got very complex. I simplified it quite a bit for that article. But I think the basic idea was, you know, you could take six golf balls and hit them with exactly the same club, with the same velocity, with the same swing, and they'll all do slightly different things. And it has to do with how the interior is formed, you know, how many winds, the rubber band there are. Did you ever take a golf ball apart when you were a kid?
I did, yes.
Yeah, why did we all do that?
I know. I think everybody did. I remember being in my friend's garage, and we both had hatchets, and we were trying to trying to chop golf balls in half. Which was this is what you do in the 70s with no parental people watching.
Exactly, right.
Just get an axe, and try and cut a golf ball in half.
And then you rapidly discover that the axe bounces back in your forehead.
That's right. And it was a cement floor and of this garage. So sparks began flying at times, and we're 10 years old. This is what it's like growing up in the 70s.
All you were missing was the matches and gasoline.
Well, the gasoline wasn't very far away. It was in the garage.
Okay, and it's good to have parks near that, so you were doing the right thing. So you know, you could have different windings, different directions. It could bulk up this way or that. Some of them had acid cores, some didn't. But if you can't saw or cut that golf ball in half, which as you found is kind of hard to do.
Yes, it is.
What you can do is watch how it flies through the air and how it spins. And you can infer what's going on inside and a little bit about the structure by watching that. Okay. So that was what he was saying. Then he started talking about, you know, precession of the axis and that kind of stuff. And it got a little more complicated. But
right.
He's hoping. And, you know, he said this is kind of a touch-and-go mission. But he says, I'm hoping that we're going to be there long enough and operating long enough to get a good sample. And he thinks that they can of enough orbits that he can detect what he needs to detect to figure out what he wants to down to a certain level of accuracy.
Mm. Now, the other thing that you really concentrate on in the article that you wrote was, in fact, what not so much what the scientists are going to see, but what they're going to hear. Explain a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of radio science going on. So, you know, we photographed Jupiter really thoroughly from Galileo because it had really state-of-the-art cameras on it at the time. And so you can only learn so much by looking at the tops of the clouds, which is what you're seeing, you know. So you're seeing all these colored bands, and these are vortexes. Each of these bands is a zone that's spinning opposite to the one next to it, and there's all these turbulences in between them, which is what the Great Red Spot is, and that's really interesting, and you can learn a lot. But by using radio science, so everything from microwaves to tracking the radio signal of the probe itself, they're able to actually, as I said, look down inside and see what kind of what the atmosphere content is in terms of water, and then also the speed deviation of the spacecraft, so they can learn more about the interior. So it's, as one of the guys at JPL, DC Eagle, said, this is really kind of a squiggly line mission more than it's a photographic mission because you're looking at graphs.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's a good description of it.
Yeah, okay. And by the way, people can track the progress of Juno at the NASA website, correct?
Not only can they track it, they can go on there and actually enter a suggestion as to where to point the Juno cam, because since it's so well mapped, this is really as much of a PR device as anything else. So the public gets to direct where they point the camera at the cloud tops. And I thought that's really smart PR. Those guys just know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. Very, very
Isn't
cool.
It?
Yeah.
When's it? Than Independence Day.
When will it come back?
It's not. It's going to be deorbited in about, I think it's 17 months. So they'll stay there for a certain period of time, a year and a half, of almost 2 years. And then they don't want to just leave it, you know, it'll get cooked after a certain amount of time.
Sure.
Going
right.
Planet, even though it's got this, you know, alloy vault around the electronics and so forth, it can only take so much. So while it's still, while the computer's still working, while there's still enough fuel, they want to make sure that they fire the rockets and push it down into Jupiter's atmosphere to burn up, because what they don't want is for it to bump into one of the moons where there might be water, possibly microbial life, and they don't want to contaminate it with a spacecraft splattering onto the surface.
Mm. Okay. All right, listen, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Rod, I want to talk about some of the other probes that are out there, okay?
Very good.
All right, hang on a second. Rod Pyle is with us, and you can get information about Rod's books at pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E-books.com. We have a link to all of this stuff on my Facebook page, on our Facebook page. You can check it out at facebook.com/NickDShow, link to all of Rod's books and all the information and all the stuff we're talking about. It's facebook.com/NickDShow. More Space Talk coming up. If you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200. Also, text 312-981-7200 with your Wildcard Wednesday request. We'll be right back. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, coming up in a little bit after the 3 o'clock news, we're going to talk about 50 things that you need to eat in Chicago. And I want to hear from you. What place and what dish are necessary that if you're in Chicago, you got to try it, you got to eat it? Somebody comes in from out of town, you take them to this restaurant, and they eat this specific dish. We've got 50 of them here. We'll talk about that. And more. 312-981-7200 for talk and text and your request for Wildcard Wednesday. But we're back here talking with Rod Pyle about space. All right. Hi, Rod.
Hey.
So Juno's not the only space probe out there. And what are some of the other ones? Where are they and what are they doing? What are some of the ones that you find most interesting?
Well, there's the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which was launched in 2009. That's a short trip out to the moon, a few days. And, you know, like a lot of stuff that JPL does in conjunction with their sister organizations within NASA and the university system, they have missions expectations for these things for anywhere from 6 months to a year, 2 years. It's been operating since 2009, and it's primarily looking for water and ices on the lunar surface because they think there's a lot of water locked up as ice on the moon, probably up by the poles. And where you've got ice water, of course, you can change that water into rocket fuel and breathable oxygen and all kinds of things you can use it for. So that would be really handy to have this ready supply of those things that we need off the Earth's surface already. So instead of paying $8,000 or $10,000 a pound to launch it off the ground, you can just go to the moon and say, hey, you go over and set up the thermal imaging experiment, and I'll go melt some water here and we'll breathe that for the next 2 weeks. So that's very handy. Mm. So that's a mission that's been going on for a number of years. I think we've talked before about Dawn, which is out orbiting Ceres right now.
Right.
In the asteroid belt. And they finally, you know, those two bright dots were really whacking everybody out when it was making its approach, because it's like, I'd be darned if those things don't look like a pair of eyes, right? They're inside a crater, and they were wondering whether they were water ice, salt deposits, what they were. It looks like at this point that they're salt deposits, but what makes them kind of cool is that they appear to be the result of a bunch of water melting and gushing out of the inside of Ceres and then evaporating, flash evaporating in the vacuum and leaving the salt behind. And there's a little bit of an atmospheric haze in that crater, so there's just enough gravity there and apparently just enough coming up that it results in having this thin gas hanging around. Mm. So it's kind of cool because for a long time we figured, well, you know, the asteroids are rocks. They're just rocks. There's nothing interesting. Same thing we thought about Pluto, just a big ball of rocky ice. Turns out there's stuff going on. Apparently there's water that is or was at one time warm enough to be coming up to the surface in a liquid form. So these things are more interesting places than we thought. And in some cases, like some of Saturn's moons and so forth, there might be enough warmth to that water to harbor life. So that keeps us interested. Mars Odyssey is still orbiting Mars. That's been there since 2001. It's now, I think, officially the longest-serving spacecraft in NASA's fleet at 15 years.
Wow.
And it's got this incredible camera. It's got this incredible, huge antenna. It's like almost 10 feet across. And it's a little odd-looking because of this spacecraft, which is pretty big, already dominated by this enormous antenna. But it sent back more data than every Mars mission combined prior to this. And so they've got these high-resolution images, and they were finally, that was the spacecraft that finally pinned down the fact that there are big glaciers of water, again, with the water story on Mars, and then also these liquid seeps they found back in mid to late 2015 when NASA made that big water announcement. They had to readjust the orbit of this thing because they kept going over the spots they wanted to see at the wrong time of day, so they adjusted the orbit so that they could go over them at the proper time of day, late in the afternoon, and actually see these areas of moisture on the sides of canyons and valleys. And they said, you know what? that's new water. That wasn't there a long time ago. That's not just sustained. That's something that's damp now. So when you're into Mars and planetary geology and so forth, finding liquid water anyway is a big deal because anywhere, rather, is a big deal because where there's water, there could be life. And then we've got Cassini,
yeah,
which is still out doing its thing around Saturn, and they're going to deorbit that in 2017, make the big dive, and that's going to go down like what they're going to do with Jupiter with Juno. That's going to take a dive into Saturn so that it doesn't end up on one of the moons contaminating the surface, and that's been returning data since 2004. And that's a big one. That, if you ever go see these things at JPL, you really don't have an idea of how big they are until you stand next to them and see them spanning half the width of the room with their solar panels or their, in this case, their plutonium power supply, you know, all the way extended out so it's not interfering with the instrumentation. And they're just breathtaking. They're much larger than you think. So that's been an incredible success. And I think you had mentioned New Horizons.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, headed out to its next target. It did its thing at Jupiter, at Pluto. And they wanted to find another target for it, but it could only be about a degree off from the course it was already on because they had a limited amount of maneuvering fuel left. So they found this little object out there called MU69-2014, which I think probably needs to be renamed. And it's only about 30 miles across, so it's only about 1% the diameter of Pluto. So it's tiny, but it's another primitive object left over from the very early solar system. So, you know, they thought Pluto was going to be just a dead hunk of ice when they got there. Who knows what we'll find out at this thing. So they've got a ways to go. It's not going to get there till 2019, but it's exciting. And it's about 3 billion miles away, so they've got a lot to look forward to.
Wow, okay. We got a couple of texts, Rod.
Okay.
630 area code says, why are spacesuits in movies so much cooler than the ones they currently use?
Because they're not inflated. Spacesuits are pressure bags, so they're there to protect you from the vacuum of space. They pump them up to about 4 to 5 pounds per square inch of usually oxygen and oxygen mix. And then there's a vacuum outside. So if you're in one of the, if you talk to the astronauts, especially the early ones, they said it was as hard as a rock. Bending your arm was a major ordeal, and gripping anything was tough because the glove and the arm want to be straight. The leg want to be straight. It wants to look like a Gumby doll that hasn't been bent out of its straight shape. So, and in the movies, of course, they're not pressurized. They're just padded cloth, and they're tailored to look very cool. So, yeah, I thought Matt Damon's suit in The Martian was pretty stylish.
It was, wasn't it?
A lot of movie sci-fi suits really suck. Star Trek was never good at those, for one example. But Matt Damon's suit was really stylish. I liked it. And even Interstellar, I'll give you Interstellar, the spacesuits were hot.
Okay. All right. Brad has two questions. What did you guys think of the movie The Europa Project?
I liked it. Did you?
You know what? I never saw it.
I think it was Europa Report he's talking about.
Europa,
right?
Report, okay.
Yeah, so a small crew lands there. This mystery kind of unfolds. They do a bunch of stuff. And if I remember, if I'm thinking of the proper movie, at the very last minute, the big monster reaches in and crushes everybody, and it goes dark. And it's kind of like, oh.
Oh, wait, no, I know what that is. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I remember the film now. Yeah.
So it was Lee Shriver, I think.
Yeah.
The lead. I mean, I thought it was a really well-made, fun movie. It just ended a bit abruptly for my taste.
Right. And then Brad's second...
Like a 50s sci-fi classic, you know?
Brad's second question was, how possible will it be to find life on moons of planets as opposed to the planets themselves?
Well, if you're talking especially about the outer planets, much more likely because those moons are far enough away to not be roasted completely by the radiation, but they seem to have hot oceans, some of them. So that looks like a pretty good likelihood. Our moon, not so much. It's just a big cold rock.
Okay. Now, what about this new book, Rod, before we let you go? Tell everybody about the latest book, Amazing Stories of the Space Age.
This one's been a real thrill. I've been pitching this thing for about 3.5 years, and I got a couple of nibbles. Before I got nibbles from publishers, I actually got nibbles from a couple of TV production houses, and I said, yeah, you know, for nonfiction, that'd be great. But what I really want to do is write this book first, so give me a year. And we finally put a deal together with a publisher called Prometheus, who I worked with before a couple of times. And I basically just wanted to take – I've written a lot about the space age, but I wanted to take either missions that were thought up and never flown or things that we didn't know about, missions that we thought we knew all about. Mm-hmm. So in that latter category is after Apollo 11 landed, the guys were getting ready to go out. A fuel plug froze in a fuel line, and the pressure started going up really fast. And the guys on the ground were afraid that the thing was going to explode. and they were talking back and forth between the contractor and Mission Control and everybody trying to figure out, A, do we have to get these guys off the service right now? And B, should we even tell them? What should we do here?
Yeah.
So that was kind of a concerning moment. And then as far as missions that weren't flown, there's a ton of them, but probably the coolest one was Project Horizon, which was the late 1950s, Wernher von Braun working with the U.S. Army at the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama, planning a military base on the moon that would include, I think it was 20 astronaut soldiers, and they were going to have weapons to counter an overland or over-crater Soviet attack, including nuclear bazookas.
Whoa!
So you got this little one-tenth of a kiloton nuclear football-sized warhead for your bazooka, and there comes Johnny Red, and you just send it right down his throat, and
wow,
that's the end of their moon base and their soldiers. Yeah,
wow.
They didn't fly that one, but they talked about it a lot.
They talked about that one a lot. All of that is in Amazing Stories of the Space Age. Is it available now, Rod?
No, that's coming out in just before Christmas.
Okay, just before Christmas, but we got a little preview for you here. All the information that you can find at pylebooks.com, that's P-Y-L-E-books.com, and we have a link on our Facebook page. Rod, always a pleasure to talk to you, man. It's always a blast, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
It's been great. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care. Rod Pyle, everybody. He's great. We'll take a quick break. We got the news coming up next on WGN.